We are creatures here just like all the others. We didn't create them, and we have no right to destroy them. We're losing species today at, you know, 1,000 times the rate that species do normally go extinct. We are killing off the rest of the creation.
The thing that's at the heart of our daily lives is the abundance of cheap fossil fuel. That's what's made us rich. The problem is that same fossil fuel is now killing us.
When everything is at stake, what is more valuable? Answers or questions? We find both in a new film from two self-proclaimed old dogs, filmmakers John Ankeley and Anne McSood. Their new film is The Wisdom to Survive, Climate Change, Capitalism, and Community. Anne joins us now on Radio EcoShock. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be on your show, and I'm sorry that John is not with us because he and I have been very much equal partners in dozens and dozens of films for the past 25 years. So I'll speak from my point of view, but he's very much part of the film. I just wanted to say that.
I got it. Well, we can only really talk to one of you at a time, the way my setup is. So there is a progression in this film beyond what I would expect. First, I want to ask you, would you introduce our listeners to the movie? What set you on the path to making The Wisdom to Survive?
Well, I live in Woodstock, Vermont, and in 2011, every summer in July, we have something called Bookstock, which is a festival of authors and books and language. And Bill McKibben was the keynote speaker in 2011, and I was asked to introduce him. And I knew he had a new book out called Earth, and I had resisted reading it. And I thought, I better read this thing if I'm going to introduce him. And so I read the book, and it literally blew my mind. I mean, it was a wake-up call for me, even though I'd been talking about climate change for probably 20 years. It had not really gone deeply into me until I read that book. And I remember sitting next to him in the town hall where he was going to do his talk, and I said, we need to amplify this message. Could we do an interview? And he said yes. And then I thought to myself, well, if one book could change me to that extent and make me determined to spend the rest of my life working on this issue, then maybe a film could change other people. And so it turned out to be way more than an interview with just Bill. It started there, and then we ended up interviewing 23 other people, and the film kind of just developed that way. But that's what started it.
So it was a journey for you. Who are some of the other people woven into this film?
Well, a lot of them are Vermonters, and partly because I live there and have access, but really mainly because Vermont is a very interesting place these days, and there's so much going on in terms of sort of systems of transition into a harder time that we're coming up upon, that I thought that maybe the film could sort of hold Vermont up as a model of what communities can do and regions can do to prepare for the impacts of climate change. So we started there, but that wasn't enough because as we looked at the impacts of climate change in the global South, we felt we had to interview people there, and we felt we had to interview women, especially from the global South. And then we felt like we had to interview Native Americans from our country. And so it just kind of grew. I remember reading that Robert Frost said that his poem, he didn't know the end when he began, and it sort of melted on itself like an ice cube. And there was an element of that in this film. We would interview one person, and then they'd say, well, you better see so-and-so, and then we'd go there, and it kind of developed that way, which is probably part of its strength and also some of its weakness, maybe.
It starts in a place which are sort of the standard problems of environmentalism. We bond with whales, we see nature disappearing, vanishing into tar sands and blown mountaintops. And then it develops far beyond that. But why did you begin there? Did you try and picture people right where they were starting out?
You know, we had about 400 pages of transcript. So where to start? You could almost start anywhere. I think, speaking for myself, I started where my deepest grief is, which is to look at what is happening to life on Earth. You know, I mean, we do start with the whales. And that's not really necessarily even a part of climate change. I mean, it's a small part, but the slaughter of the whales has been going on, and before climate change, we became conscious of that. But it is that disregard for other species or that ability to cause that kind of suffering that I think is the deepest cause of climate change. So I feel as though people are grieving about what's happening to life on Earth. And whether they're aware of it or not, I don't know. I watch at the screenings that we've had. We've had three or four screenings of this film since it came out, and I watch people put their eyes down and look away in the beginning of the film. And I encourage them not to do that, to just look at it in the eye for just the short time that those difficult images are there. There's a woman in the film, she's an environmental teacher from the University of Vermont, and she says, if we fail to really look at the suffering that's happening to the animals and to other species, if we will look at it, then the opportunity for action will arise. And I'm thinking, well, maybe if we don't look at it and really dare to look at it and let it in, then maybe the opportunities for action won't arise. So I think starting there was the place where I start, and John too. But it could have started anywhere.
Well, it's a common problem. I have it too with interviews. Now, Anne McSood, we may both be old dogs. Do you think that makes us more or less sensitive to the idea that climate change is an intergenerational crime?
Alex, I think, I don't know about the sensitivity. I certainly found young people whom we interviewed were passionately sensitive about this. But what I do think about old dogs, I'll include John in that too. He and I are the same age. I feel as though we have the time to really spend working with this. I think the generation under me, my children's generation, are struggling to make ends meet, single parents, all of that, so that we're the ones with the leisure. Have, at least I am a person who doesn't have a 9-to-5 job, and I can spend this time. So more sensitive. I did read a study that Yale put out about the climate project that said that the elders are more engaged in climate change, maybe statistically, but that's not what I found as I went around and interviewed the young people. So I don't know. I don't know whether part of it is also that we've messed things up for them, so we need to be more sensitive.
Well, I got to agree with that. And I think, though, that we've seen what the climate was before, so it's easier for us to register that it has really changed, that it wasn't always this messed up. And I think that's a factor. And we have, too, James Hansen, the famous NASA scientist who wrote the book really for his grandchild. I'm motivated by my grandchild. I'm very worried about what's going to happen for his little life.
You know, Bill McKibben says in the film at one point, he said that the world will never be as beautiful as it is today. And he said, and I'm very aware of that, and I pay attention. He said, it's our job to appreciate it and pay attention. And he said, and I do. And I was very moved by that, because that's the way I feel. I feel when we have one spectacularly beautiful day, that they're not going to be that many as we come down the pike. So,
won't science or technology find a way out of this, though? I mean, your guests seem sure that human ingenuity won't pull off a surprise that'll get us out of climate change or the energy problem.
Yes, that was Roger Payne, the whale biologist, who said, I think he was referring to solve the problem of running out of water in Los Angeles. And he said in a kind of mocking way, oh, well, that's no problem. We'll just build a giant desalination plant. And he said, sure, we will if we want to spend the money. And then he talks about how somebody did an estimate of the services that the environment do for us, and that if we added it up, it would come to $30 trillion a year. So I think whether or not science will find some trick to technology and get us out of this, that's not the deeper question. The deeper question is, if we could flip a switch and have all renewable energy exactly at the same extent to which we are energized right now, is that really the way we want to live on the planet? Feels to me that wouldn't be okay. It just feels that excess that we have now would work itself out in some other problems, and that the real question is to reconsider what it means to be alive on the planet and what it means to be a human being as part of this web of life. So I don't know whether the other guests would have said that technology will do it, and I don't know what your other guests have said, but I'm always tempted to wish they would find something that would be magical. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think so. I think that the problems we're facing are baked into the cake of the technologies we're using. Just look at nuclear power, for example. That was supposed to be the big answer, and it's turned out to be the big problem after Fukushima. I want to say this is Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith with Anne McSood, talking about her new film, The Wisdom to Survive. And I wonder if it's a cliche or idealization to think that Aboriginal people have answers the rest of us can't see. Tell us about your experiences interviewing Native people in America and in other parts of the world.
I wondered about the fact that we were only interviewing three Native Americans in Arizona at a reservation in Arizona, and I thought it felt pretty token to me at the time. You know, oh, we have to get the Native Americans in to the film. But when I met them and heard that the interviews, we only cut small amounts of it, but the whole interview of each of those three people was very transformative for me. I left there quite changed in realizing that these young people, all three of them were young, they don't have that disconnection that so many of us have from nature. It's just not part of their language. It's already a deep assumption that we're part of this web of life and that if we disturb the energy, then we will be unwell as a species. And when I left, I felt as though I had understood something that for me before had been a cliche, but it helped me. I don't know how it comes across in the film because we had to go over it quite lightly. The other aspect of it is also that they're dealing with one of the most dreadful impacts of climate change, and that is the shortage of water where they live. So that was the other reason for going there.
It was great to see many young activists and thinkers in this movie, especially the women. Was that a conscious choice for you, and why does that matter?
No, I think it was a conscious choice to make sure we got young people. Because when we started out in Vermont with Gus Speth and Bill McKibben and, you know, the professors from UVM, we had a lot of sort of elder white people, and we knew we needed to get young people in there. And then I think that there's this one young woman in California who was part of reclaiming the commons and taking back some public space from the University of California, and they were planting a big garden illegally. And she said at one point in her interview that a colleague had said, if it's the right thing to do, then we're right to be doing it. And that really struck a chord with me. It's made me much bolder since then about this idea of reclaiming the commons, that this common space belongs to all of us. And, you know, I don't really know whether any of this was a conscious choice, except we knew we needed to see people who were really working in the area of climate change, and we were led to these people.
Well, this whole question of the commons has been going on for hundreds of years, and it was really a fine moment in the film to see people gardening while police officers with badges were filming them doing it. I thought, okay, gardening, the new crime, the new terrorism.
Exactly,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, boy.
And you noticed how ineffectual the police were, really.
Yeah.
You could see they didn't want to be there either.
No, they've got better things to do. Well, look, Anne, the movie title claims to take on capitalism, but I found the section wasn't too clear about what we should do about it. I know it's a huge question to ask, but did you develop a sense that there is an option to capitalism?
Well, you know, even naming capitalism in our subtitle was frowned upon by some who said, oh, you're going to lose a whole audience if you attack capitalism. But I think that we're at a time now where we can't not look at capitalism as a primary cause of everything that's going on. So we wanted to talk about capitalism, and Joel Covell is a person who has written a book called The End of Nature, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism, or The End of the World. And I feel as though until we take a real good look at capitalism and not just tweaking it or regulating it, but looking at it as a system that is failing, then I think we'll never work our way out of this mess. I'm not sure we will anyway, but certainly we won't if we don't come to terms with the causes of climate change, which is this industrial growth society. I guess alternatives to capitalism is the big problem. And I'm guessing, Alex, that's why, you know, year after year after year, nothing really changes. Maybe we don't know what to do if we don't have a system like capitalism. Or what do we do if capitalism, as Joanna Macy in the film suggests, is collapsing and destroying itself at the core? Well, what kind of chaos will that provide? So in trying to figure out how I'm going to deal with that, I've just gotten super local in my own community and think maybe that the other system, at least during this transition, will be just to hunker down locally and work on local food systems and local economies. But I don't know. It's a huge question and one that can kind of make you pretty hopeless sometimes because people don't want to tamper with capitalism, and also that, you know, it's hard to decouple that from democracy. Those two things are put together in people's minds. So it's been a tough one.
Well, speaking of decoupling, we know that wealth is accumulating rapidly in the hands of just a few people. In one statistic, just 85 people control the same wealth as the poorest half of all the rest of the people on Earth. Is this process of accumulation at the top just a historic trend that runs parallel to climate change, or do you feel that the two are very linked?
Yeah, I feel like they're essentially linked. I saw that statistic, too. I think that was just yesterday or the day before. Did you just read that?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it took a while for that to sink in. 85 people and 4.5 billion people. I mean, that is so monumentally unfair that how could it not be linked to the collapse of civilization and the collapse of the world around us? Yes, I think they're entirely linked.
Well, we seem to have this fossil-burning machine. I mean, our suburbs are machines that burn, our cities are, our lives are, I'm doing it too. That seems to be almost what we do for a living, is just take things out of the ground and throw them up into the atmosphere. So as long as that's part of the wealth accumulation process, they're not going to stop it. They're making money out of it, whether it's oil companies or the tar sands or whatever. Too much money being made, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not going to stop, and Stephanie Kazet deals with that in the movie, talking about some of the things that may come, like more resource wars and more of a fascist state. I agree. She said we're not going to give that up lightly. But I wonder if Joanna Macy isn't right. I mean, if she, Joanna Macy, who's going to be 85 her next birthday, and if some of your listeners don't know her, she's a eco-philosopher and a Buddhist scholar. She's said she'd love to retire, but there's just much too much to do. So she does workshops and writes. And anyway, she thinks that there's no need to go attack capitalism because it's quickly collapsing. So I would think that a symptom of that collapse would be that statistic that you just said. How long can we go on this way? So maybe there won't be some kind of conscious choice to change our ways, but our ways are going to change.
Right. Well, going to the voices towards the end of the film, what's the role of permaculture, and do you really think we can feed the world on that?
Oh, you have that wonderful Vermonter, Ben Falk, who's got a wonderful permaculture organization going on. And it was a relief to film him because it was so positive. But, of course, I had the thought was, well, how many people can you feed with this little farm? I'm sure you've had guests who are experts on this. I don't think there's been that much research on how are we going to feed ourselves. And I looked up to see that many grants are being given now for people to study regional food systems and how will we have food security. I mean, it's one of my worst nightmares if I allow myself to think about the hunger that's happening and the food refugees that we're going to have. So do I think permaculture can solve it? Theoretically, I would think that if everybody grew food in their own region, that it could feed that region. But I don't know what the studies would show. It feels like an impossible situation.
We are in an impossible situation, but we have to carry on anyway. Who do you think this film is for? Is it for those who already know about these issues or for those who don't know about these issues?
Well, first of all, when I first wanted to make it, it was going to be for people who hadn't awakened to this yet, as I had not really on some deep level. So it was going to be to wake people up and recruit them to become part of the solution and to become active and to not turn away anymore. But as I've worked with the film over the past year and a half, I've realized that it may be more useful for the people who already know, because what we found in our first several screenings is that people appreciate so much the fine line between despair and, I won't say hope, because hope is discussed in the film, and as Joanna Macy said, you know, when you're in the middle of an adventure, you don't have time to figure out whether you feel hopeless or hopeful. But what was hopeful for me was to be in the company of people who haven't given up and who are loving their lives in spite of this catastrophe and who are happy and celebrative and who laugh a lot, and yet their whole lives are dedicated to this issue. So I think it's for both. I wait to see, because it's just so newly out that we haven't had enough feedback about how it can be used.
Okay, so how do listeners find out more about your new movie?
All right. Well, as you said, as you already introduced me as an old dog, we're olddogdocumentaries.org, and it's on our homepage, and the educational buyers from universities will be clicked over to Bullfrog Films. They've picked up the film. And then people who want to buy it for their own church groups or community screenings or for home use will stay on our website.
That sounds good. We've been talking with filmmaker Anne McSood with her partner John Ankeley. She's released the movie The Wisdom to Survive, Climate Change, Capitalism, and Community. You can find links to that also in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. And thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.